The Church of God the Eternal presents Good News Through Symbols, the third message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled The Good News of God's Kingdom, for the second day of the Feast of Tabernacles, in Townsend, Tennessee, October 8th, 2025.
Well, this third message now this morning on day number two of the Feast of Tabernacles, we're going to continue on with my series concerning the good news of God's kingdom. And it really is good news. We've talked about why that the literal established government of Jesus Christ upon this earth physically is going to be great news for the human family. We talked yesterday about the undergirding principles of the doctrines, which actually define the essence of that good news master plan, which happens to include a lot of teachings that the churches of the world don't agree with at all. And in fact, as I mentioned to you, if you tell them what you believe, they'll probably think you're a heretic. And yet, it's the substance of the truth concerning who and what this God is and why he brought it into being and what he's doing to offer this good news salvation opportunity to every human being who has ever lived or who will ever live. So you understand those things because you've been called, your mind has been open. And so those doctrines hated by the world are part of the good news. And a day is coming when they're going to have a chance likewise to be called and then to come to value them, and then to implement them, and to be blessed by them. Today, we're going to focus on another aspect of this good news. God is teaching us about his glorious kingdom to come by using physical principles in this world right now that help us to understand better. Symbols, if you will. And we all take them for granted. But they were created by God to try and help us bridge this gap between our physical three-dimensional world to understand something about what I call a fourth dimension existence where God lives. The symbolism of family in particular is key to this understanding. So the good news of the future that God has in store is revealed in God's particular commands upon this earth regarding families and family relationships. Why did God make the rules concerning families the way he did? He could have done anything he wanted. But he did it in a particular way. What is God actually doing? I mean, we're going to start with the most simple question. What's the real purpose for your existence, my existence, the existence of this earth? What's this really all about? Bottom line, do you have a simple bullet point answer for that? Is God, did he just want to create a Broadway play and we're all actors because he enjoys watching the show? Or is there a definitive purpose for everything that exists in the way it's being done? Well, here's the answer that Mr. Herbert Armstrong gave us decades ago, and we believe this was inspired by God, not through the mind of any man. And what we were taught and believe is absolutely true today, God is recreating himself through human beings. That's what's going on. The purpose of everything that exists, God is recreating himself through human beings. Here's actually how Mr. Armstrong described it. He said, quote, "The divine family is God. There is one God," meaning the one family, consisting of more than one person. And this gets into the whole debate over the nature of God. You know, and every religion has their own definition. Monotheism, Trinitarianism, and we're neither. I think the world scholars call us binitarians, meaning we believe in two gods. No, we only believe in one God. But we believe God is like the family name, the surname, that is actually applied to many different beings who then collectively are called God. There is one God, the one family consisting of more than one person. God then purposed to reproduce himself through humans, made in his image and likeness, with the possibility of being born into the divine family begotten by God the Father. And that is why God put man on the earth. So there is a succinct statement, I would say, that undergirds our understanding of everything that's going on, the whys and the wherefores. God is going to share his power and his glory with many members of that family. There's only two that we know of, the one we call the Father, the one we call Jesus Christ. In the beginning or before the institution of this particular master plan on this earth, they weren't Father and Son. That's why Mr. Armstrong referred to them as God of the first part and God of the second part, which I think is important. It's going to be important today from the way that I'm going to give you this material. They were not always Father and Son, which means it wasn't parent and child. The one who became Jesus Christ became a son only after he was born of a human mother. And now, all of a sudden, God the Father was his father and he was a son. Before that, they had an absolute loving, perfect, unified relationship from the beginning. Well, neither one of them from eternity, because there was no beginning for either one of them. But how do you describe, how does this God family, these two beings who exist in a relationship in the fourth dimension, and now you've created human beings on an earth in three dimensions, how do you describe that existence when we have a limit, like a lid on our minds that prevent our understanding? And we can't. We can't understand, we can't see four dimensions. It would be like if you had a two-dimensional person living like on a sheet of paper, flat, and they exist on this single plane, not three dimensions at all. How do you explain three dimension to a two-dimensional being? It'd be impossible. They have no reference point. The same is true. You and I have no reference point to understand four dimensions or five dimensions with the limits of the way God made us. So he gave us symbols in our existence to give us hints. Our special music we heard was from this morning was taken from 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter. And there are quotes from that chapter that the Apostle Paul was inspired to write concerning the limits of our understanding. We'll be talking about that. What does that have to do with family? The family relationships, the rules that God established for human beings on this earth, are God's means to try to describe something about the God family in the fourth dimension. That's why they were created. 1 John 3, verse 1 to begin this morning. 1 John 3, and beginning in verse 1, "Behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God." So, we're called sons, all right? And that, we're talking about children, we're talking about offspring, we're talking about parent-child relationship. "That we should be called the sons of God, therefore the world knows us not, because it knew him not." Verse 2, "Beloved, now are we the sons of God." There it is repeated. "Doth not appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him." Talking about we can't comprehend, we can't fathom the dimension of God in the spirit realm. We just know in faith that when he returns and when that first resurrection takes place, when we're added, God willing, into that family, then you will understand it and you'll see it in the four dimensions. "But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is." Right now, we don't see him as he is. The best we can do is learn about his character, In essence, what makes God tick? What does God love? What does God hate? How he thinks, how he behaves? That's the best we can really achieve. But we can't comprehend the existence in the spirit realm yet. Verse 3, and every man that hath this hope in him purifies himself even as he is pure. So there's an obligation upon us to do something if we want to share in that permanent eternal relationship. The point of it all is to expand the family of God. Instead of just two beings who have this perfect, unified, loving relationship, to turn that into millions or even billions. That too is beyond our comprehension, isn't it? There's nothing to compare to that. There's no group of human beings on the earth who have that kind of unity. It's hard to get people to agree. So think about just two agreeing. Okay, that's one thing. Now think about a million or a billion people all agreeing in perfect harmony. All individual personalities. We're not talking about drones. We're not talking about the Borg. We're talking about individuals with their own unique appearance and their personalities, and yet absolutely choosing to be on one page when it comes to what is important and what is true and what is false and what is good and what is evil, and working together in perfect harmony and unity. That's mind-boggling. So how do we begin to wrap our minds around it when we can't really? So God gave us things on this earth to help give us hints, to help us to try and see elements of it and to practice elements of it. Hebrews 2, verse 9. Hebrews 2, beginning in verse 9. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. For it became him of whom are all things and by whom are all things. And remember, yesterday, one of those doctrines we discussed, the idea that Jesus Christ was the God of the Old Testament, not the Father. Father hasn't had any direct intervention, hasn't spoken to a human being. So when God spoke to Moses, when God wrestled with Jacob, that wasn't the Father. That was the one who became Jesus Christ. That was, I gave you yesterday, Romans 8, 16 and 17. I'm not going to reread that again. And the description of children of God being heirs, so that what Christ experiences in his relationship is the same thing you're going to have a chance to have as well. Became him of whom are all things and by whom are all things to bring many sons unto glory. There it again. There it's uttered. That's God's purpose. That's the mission. That's what this whole thing is about. Bringing many sons. What is a son? A son is a child. So what are we talking about? We're talking about a family relationship. Talking about, you don't have a son unless you have a parent, right? A son or a daughter is an offspring. To make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. So Jesus Christ showed us the way by being willing to suffer and to die as an example for what you and I need to learn to be willing to do as well. For both he that sanctifieth and they who are sanctified are all of one. For which cause he is not ashamed to call them brethren. Okay, we got a new term now, brethren. Oh, we just say, oh, brethren, brothers. But what are we talking about? We're talking about family relationship, aren't we? Brethren is just the plural for brother, isn't it? And it doesn't matter whether it's brother or sister. You were still talking about a relationship now of children who have the same parent. And all these, we read these passages and take them all for granted very easily. And yet, embedded in it is family, isn't it? Parent, child, brother, brother, sister. It's a part of the verbiage that God uses to try to help us to see details about what he's doing. And so Christ is not ashamed to call us I'll call it mutual siblings. Like the joint heirs of Romans 8:17. Verse 12, saying, I will declare thy name unto my brethren. In the midst of the church will I sing unto thee, and again I will put my trust in him, and again, behold, I and the children which God hath given me. So Jesus Christ is described as the one who has the children. They were a gift of the Father, and yet Christ is like being presented as the Father. Wait a minute, that's confusing. If the Father is the Father, Jesus is the Son, and yet Christ is described here as having the children that the Father gave to him. So which is it? I'm going to go into a lot more of that in the next message, which you're going to get in a couple of days, with the admonition not to mix the metaphors. They're all important, and they give you a different description of a different element, a facet, if you will, of this plan, so that you can understand different elements to it. But we have to use those symbols in the right way. But it's all about family relationships, and most importantly, it's about the unity of beings working together in harmony. Genesis 1:26, let's go back to the beginning. Genesis 1:26, and God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. Why were they given dominion over physical creatures on the earth, which are here today and gone tomorrow? And you'll get it more on the last great day, but this physical earth and all these other creatures on the earth are all going to be burned up one day. They're not going to be eternal. There's going to be a new heavens and a new earth to replace the one that exists now. So why? Why give human beings dominion over the earth and the creatures on the earth? It's a part of the training program for a greater purpose. But we were made in the image of God. We weren't made to look like angels. We were made to look like God himself. Every single one of us. Even though every single one of us looks different, I mean, you're absolutely distinguishable from every other one and on the whole earth. And yet every single one was created in the image of God. Malachi 2, verse 15. A prophecy condemning the apostasy of God's ministry, and it applies absolutely to the last days, but just lifting out verse 15 in particular for reason. He's actually talking about the apostasy concerning the teaching on divorce and remarriage, the sanctity of marriage, because it is so critical. And when God's church literally corrupts the marriage command, it does incredible damage to families and individuals. And so God is calling it out here. Verse 15, did not he make one? We're going to see more scriptures to say, yeah. He made one how? Made them Siamese twins? No. He created marriage. That's what he did. The institution that takes a man and a woman, and it's sad that I almost have to say it's one man and one woman. But that's what it is. It's one man and one woman who are eligible according to God's other rules. And then they take each other for life, life partners. Human beings are supposed to mate for life. We see that in nature, according to, you know, to some creatures that God made. Well, human beings are supposed to be one of those who mate for life. And they become one how? Working together as long as they both continue to live. Did not he make one? Yeah. Yet, had he the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one? Why one? Why force this contrived set of rules to make human beings jump through hoops to make marriages work. Here's the answer: that he might seek a godly seed. I started from the beginning to tell you it's about God reproducing himself through human beings to expand and to give and share the glory and the power of his family with many children. And so why marriage? That he might seek a godly seed. And that doesn't just mean physical children that come from families that follow his rules who were blessed. No, it's talking about ultimate inheritors of the kingdom. Big picture. That he might seek a godly seed. A reconfirmation of the overriding mission of why all this exists. And now we have a hint that marriage is integral to it. But my dear friends, would you be surprised and shocked and a little upset for me to tell you that marriage was created only temporarily? Marriage is not a permanent institution. Are you shocked? Do you think I'm going apostate? When did marriage come into being? Did marriage exist in the God family from antiquity, of eternity, never having a beginning like God never had a beginning? No. Marriage was instituted for the first time after human beings were put on this earth for the first time. Very much like the Sabbath, by the way. If you want a comparison, I'm not turning to it in Mark 2, verse 27, where Christ was having to teach the Jews, who should have known better because they had made the Sabbath a burden, with all of their added on rules that God never intended. Do this, do that, whatever. And what did Christ tell them? The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The very fact that the Sabbath was made for man tells you it did not precede the creation of man. And in fact, human beings, Adam and Eve, were created on day 6, and the Sabbath, the first Sabbath that ever existed in the universe, was on day 7. So which came first? Man came first, Sabbath came next. What does that have to do with anything? I thought we were talking about families. I'm talking about what's eternal, ever existent, versus that that is temporary in nature. Do you think the Sabbath is going to last forever? No, it's not. The Sabbath is going to last only as long as this physical earth, the sun and the moon, exists, because that's the clock that actually helps you count out days. There's no such thing as a seventh day unless the days are being counted. And on the last great day, you'll hear, it's all going to be replaced by a new heavens and a new earth. The clock is going to be replaced, which means there's no way to count it anymore. God's not subject to time. From antiquity, God doesn't count out days, which is why the Bible says a day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years is as a day, meaning it's irrelevant to God. You and I can't conceive of that because we're absolutely glued to the clock and we cannot speak in terms outside a timeline. Try it. Try to talk without time. Before, later, yesterday, today, tomorrow. It's all time. God's not bound by time. So God's not bound by days, which means day 1 and day 7 are irrelevant to him. They were made relevant to human beings as long as there are human beings. What happens when there's no more human beings? Because at the end of this master plan that we're celebrating during this 8-day feast, human beings are not going to exist anymore. They will either have been changed and added to the God family as eternal beings, or else they're going to go to sleep forever. There will be no more human beings. If the Sabbath was made for man and there's no more man, there's no more Sabbath either. What's my point? There also is a time coming when there will be no more marriage. Because marriage did not exist before. It was created for human beings on this earth right now. Therefore, it will only exist as a physical principle as long as there are human beings. But I know that's going to trouble some. I suspect it will. Matthew 22, verse 29. Matthew 22, verse 29, Jesus answered and said to them, "You do err, not knowing the scripture, nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage." This was, the Jews were having this battle between basically the sects of the Sadducees and the Pharisees. One believing in the resurrection and the other not. So now they're going to try and bring Jesus into their debate and see who he will side with or try to trip him up. So the ones who don't believe, given this scenario, well, okay, a woman, she got married, her husband died, then she married another one, and then he died, and consecutively she had seven husbands. In the resurrection, whose wife will she be? And Jesus called him out and said, that's an idiotic question. In the resurrection, meaning for spirit beings born into the God family, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven. Meaning what? See, this doesn't mean they're going to be angel class beings. It means in that regard, they are like angels, meaning what? Sexless. Angels have no gender. They are neither male nor female. And here, Jesus confirmed, neither is God. God class beings have no gender, even as angels have no gender. So how do you have marriage without male and female? You don't. He had to create male and female first, and then marriage. And when there's no more male and female, there's no more marriage either. Back to Genesis 1, verse 27. Genesis 1, 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. God, the Father, Jesus Christ, are neither male nor female. We refer to them as a male gender for the sake of the authority that they hold. But technically, there is no gender with them. They do not have either male or female sexual organs. That was given only to human beings. The purpose of male and female was to teach us about authority in the God family. That's what you're going to get. Why did he give it? If it doesn't exist now in the God realm, why subject us to it? To teach us something very, very important about the God realm. And it's about authority that exists. Verse 28. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it under authority and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, over every living thing that moves upon the earth. So he wanted male and female to produce children. And I've already given you the answer in the back of the book because that's the whole purpose. He wants to share his God glory with many, many members of that family. And he chose to do it through the process of human birth from a union between male and female that produces offspring. He could have done anything he wanted. He could have had it so that a man and a woman touch fingers and a baby appears. He didn't do it. He could have done anything he wanted, but the way he did it has reason and purpose. But it's to teach us something about a fourth dimension because our minds can't fathom that. But it can fathom things that he created in relationships upon this earth temporarily. According to God's rules for human beings, when he created male and female, and he wanted them to repopulate, he wanted them to bring many children, but he gave rules and guidelines for how to do it. As I mentioned to you, I already read you from Malachi 2. It's through a proper marriage relationship he wanted those children to be produced, godly seed. Not through willy-nilly one-night stands and hookups. Okay? Now, he could have said, hey, I just want as many children as I can get to potentially be born into my family, so just have sex with as many people as you possibly can. He didn't do that. He set out very specific rules for a man and a woman, both eligible, to take each other, like I said, as life partners, and then to be faithful to that relationship between them. And from that union, to produce children, legitimate children, who then are raised in a nurturing family environment so that they can be blessed and helped, likewise to grow up and to follow the rules and find a life mate and to bring new children into existence and to teach them to be blessed as well so they grow up to be healthy, well-adjusted adults and find marriage partners and produce more children and on and on and on and on. Now, that's the ideal way. How much is that real? Hardly. Hardly. But it's the only right way for blessing on this earth right now for human beings. Genesis 2, verse 21. Genesis 2, 21, the eternal God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib which the eternal God had taken from man made he a woman and brought her unto the man. And Adam said, and I think this is interesting because God didn't say, Adam said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. I guess it's probably one of the reasons that a lot of feminists and God haters would like to get rid of, you know, all of those labels and titles because they came from the Bible. Verse 24, therefore, because this happened, and God created them male and female and made the woman literally out of a body part of the man, therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife. There it is. There's your institution of marriage. A man who has a wife is married. And they shall be one flesh. Yes, a physical union, but more so a harmony of working together in partnership. Because that partnership of marriage is supposed to signify a level of unity and agreement and cooperation that exists in the God realm. The God beings aren't male and female. But through marriage of human beings, he wanted us to have to learn what it's like to get along and to cooperate and to learn to work together in harmony. How does that work? Ooh, not so well. We find it very difficult because we're carnal and we don't operate with the mind of God and the fullness of the Holy Spirit to make us like Jesus Christ, ever willing to be a perfect sacrifice. By nature, we fight over who's in charge. You see, in the God family, you don't fight over who's in charge. The one we call the Father is in charge, and the one we call the Son is willingly in subjection to his Father's authority. Even though he's fully God as the Father is God, and technically the one we call Jesus Christ has as much power, superpower, as the Father. But we can't imagine that. Well, then why is he subjected when he's equally as powerful? He could make himself equal or try to fight the other one for supremacy. Because they love each other. And the one is willingly subject to the authority of the other. Willingly. They have unity in the God family because one has authority and the other is willingly subject to it, even though God of the second part has just as much power. Every aspect of God, omnipotent, omniscience, omnipresence, but is willingly subject. And so how does God try to describe that to human beings when we don't live in the fourth dimension? By giving us marriage and saying, learn to work together, but it's a relationship of authority. Why did he make it at that? Why couldn't he have said, you each have an equal say, you're 50-50 partners? Because then we wouldn't be learning the authority element of it. Oh, so men, they get to make all the decisions. You're, you know, oppressive patriarchal society. Yes, it is an oppressive patriarchal society because human beings don't follow the rules. But if they followed the rules, it would be a blessing. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Life partners, as long as they both shall live, that marriage union is permanent. So God is the author of marriage. But he only created marriage after he created human beings as male and female. And when there's no more human beings, there's no more male and female, there's no more need for marriage either. The very fact that marriage exists as an institution today in the world, even among people who hate God, is a testament to God's existence and authority. I find that highly ironic. Cultures in every nation around the world have a marriage custom, even if it's very pagan and perverted, but they have a marriage custom, the idea of two who commit to life, for life, to each other. Why do they have that? Because God made it. It exists by the expression of his authority. And even the ones who deny the existence of God actually, in part, acknowledge it. By his decree, human society would start with marriage. Call it the nuclear family. Not nuclear like an atomic, but it means a nucleus, a unit, a hub, a center of authority from which everything else emanates. And so he created as a blessing for human beings to start with marriage and then offspring of children, and that family structure then being the source of a healthy and a vibrant society upon this earth. Psalm 128, verse 1, a song of degrees. Blessed is everyone that feareth the eternal, that walks in his ways. Yeah. You want to be blessed? Pay attention to God who set the rules and follow what he said. For thou shalt eat the labor of thine hands. That's anti-communism, by the way. That means you work for it, you get the reward. Happy shalt thou be, and it shall be well with thee. There's a reason that communist societies hate marriage and family, because it is against everything they are trying to achieve. A strong family unit with a husband and a wife who produce children, with family autonomy to make the decisions for their family and to raise their children, they don't want that. They want the Hillary Clinton version. It takes a village to raise a child. No, it doesn't. It takes two parents fulfilling their obligation before God to raise a child. Communists want to do everything upside down because it's Satan-inspired. Happy shall thou be, and it shall be well with thee. Verse 3, thy wife shall be as a fruitful vine by the sides of thine house, thy children like olive plants round about the table. Behold, that thus shall the man be blessed that feareth the eternal. This is the ideal. This is the ideal temporarily, physically, on this earth for temporary human beings. Relationship of the nuclear family, appropriate husbands and wives who work together in collaboration within their assigned roles by God and are both blessed thereby, who are blessed with children whom they raise in the knowledge of God, and create or help develop healthy new adult human beings who then repeat that process. Now that's the way God designed it. And if human beings all did that, whoa, what a glorious world. Wouldn't it be? And the majority of human beings aspire to it. There's an ingrained. See, he gave us this natural affinity, this desire to want to do it. Problem is, our own carnal, selfish, perverted ideologies get in the way and mess it all up. We want the great result, we just don't want to follow the rules to achieve it. Did God create marriage and family for the purpose of making human beings happy on this earth? Some of you might be not, no. If the goal was for human beings to be happy on this earth, he wouldn't have given us so many rules. He would have made it easy for us to be happy. Seeing somebody you're attracted to, hubba hubba. Ooh, let's hook up. We get tired of each other, well, let's part ways and go find somebody new, and it's okay. And children don't need mom and dad to set boundaries and to give them a good, because God created a means for a little child to kind of grow up independent on their own and have what they need and be blessed without the nuclear family. He could have done that, but he didn't. He made us dependent. And everything is so fragile. And if all the rules of God's marriage and family are not followed exactly, bad things happen. Human beings suffer. Why did he make it that way? If the intent was to make human beings happy, why make the rules so hard to do? Because those rules weren't given to make human beings happy. That's shocking, I'm sorry. The rules were given, again, to teach us something about the fourth dimension, which is eternal, so that we learn to value and to take seriously a way of thinking and behaving that is going to be necessary if you're going to be in the God family. If you're going to have a role in that family, which I guarantee you is going to be unified and harmonious in the relationship between all of those beings, not just with the one we call the Father in Jesus Christ, but with millions and potentially billions of others. And they're all going to perfectly get along together. They're all going to have an ideology in mind that they ascribe to. And how do we learn that? How do we emulate that? By fulfilling these temporary rules concerning family on this earth right now, that's how. The ones who learn to do it good, well, within the best of their ability, are the ones that are developing the kind of character that is going to make you a good God member. The reality is, on this earth, most human beings have never enjoyed rich family life, because the rules for success go against our human nature, and we're too selfish and idolatrous and covetous, which means we mess it up. So the first way to understand, because all of you under the hearing of my voice today and beyond, you've come out of all kind of different family settings, circumstances, some good. But I would say if yours was a positive family upbringing and environment, you're probably the exception. Because I'll bet you a majority of the ones God chose to call into his church have come out of some challenging circumstances, even some very horrendous circumstances. You didn't have the benefit of a father fulfilling a father's role and a mother fulfilling a mother's role. The majority of you were not taught the truth of God as your family rule book by which you could be blessed. Some of you did. Some of you had it pretty good by comparison. A lot of you did not. And a lot of you have that desire, and you would like to have that family unity and that oneness and that accord, and to have the blissful relationships that God wrote into the possibility. But most don't experience it. In the message I give you in a couple days, we're going to talk about that. I'm going to try not to step on that material. But just for this morning, it's really about authority in the kingdom of God family. That's what these rules are all for. Ephesians 5, verse 22, you knew we were going to go there. This is where you find out while the physical is all about the spiritual. It's not an end unto itself. It pictures something else that's more important. Ephesians 5, 22, wives, submit yourself unto your husbands so that they get blissful lives and you get to be the carpet that they walk on. That's not what it says. Wives, submit yourselves unto your husbands as unto the Lord. Oh, so women who are married are supposed to think about their husband's authority in the very same way that you do about godly authority. That your husband is equal to God or perfect like, no. The authority, the relationship comes from the same source, and the one reflects the other. As unto the Lord. Verse 23, for the husband is the head of the wife. Why did it have to be that way? Because God said so. That's all we need to know. God said so. The husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. Does anybody have a problem with Christ being the head of the church? No? Well, the physical marriage relationship depicts the relationship of the church, Jesus Christ, and every single one of us as members of that body. That's what it's all about. Therefore, verse 24, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. And the limit on that everything is in the Lord, clarified in other passages. A woman who is a wife has an obligation to put God absolutely first, and if her husband is trying to make her do something which is against God's law, you put God first. But short of that, by God's decree, a married woman is subject to the ultimate edicts of the husband. So the man gets all the benefit. Not if he wants to be in God's kingdom. If a husband turns that marriage relationship into a selfish exercise, he's going to eliminate himself from ever being in the kingdom of God. Let's keep reading. Husbands, verse 25, love your wives even as Christ also loved the church. How does Christ love the church and every member in particular? Well, he was willing to sacrifice himself, right, to die when he was innocent, so that the church could live. So that's how husbands are supposed to think about their wives, being a living sacrifice, caring about them, pouring themselves out for their benefit. Verse 26, that he might sanctify and cleanse it, meaning Christ, with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. In other words, Jesus Christ wants you to succeed. He wants every single member, human being who is called into that body, to be successful in completing your conversion process and ultimately to be born into the God family. He wants that totally and completely. He is on your side. He's not trying to get something selfishly for himself at your expense. It's all about making you successful. And that's exactly the way husbands are supposed to think about their marriages and about their wives. Verse 28, so ought, just like that, so ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. because she's a part. They're partners together. You help her. You build her up. You're helping yourself. How many men do the opposite? They act selfishly, and they end up tearing down their wives and don't realize they're tearing themselves down. Verse 29, for no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, even as the Lord, the church. Well, I almost want to take exception with that, because we have an epidemic now of, you know, people who are self-loathing. It's a mental illness. I think a lot of it is demon-inspired. And things are getting worse toward the end of this age, not better. The demon activity is amplifying, which means the pressure upon us by that invisible enemy. They would love to see us destroy ourselves. How many people are on psychiatric drugs in our society today? A lot. So are there people who are actually behaving destructively to themselves, to harm themselves? Oh, yeah. And probably all the more, meaning all the more we need to insulate ourselves against that demonic activity by growing closer to God. But a healthy human being is not self-destructive. A healthy human being with a carnal mind is selfish and wants to preserve. And that is used as an example for the way we're supposed to learn to treat our wives. Verse 30, for we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones, just like was commanded back in Genesis when Adam acknowledged, she is now of my flesh and of my bones. Verse 31, for this cause, because these things are fact, because it's the way God established the rules of authority, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall be joined into his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. A direct quote of Genesis 2:24 that we already read. This is a great mystery. Wait a minute. It's no mystery. It's just spelled out, right? And yet he's calling it a mystery. Why? This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ in the church. You mean that whole thing that started back in Genesis with Adam and Eve wasn't about Adam and Eve being attracted to each other and having children? No. Male and female, marriage, the rules of marriage, life partners, from the beginning was to teach us something about the spirit realm, the love of God, and the God family. It never was about the physical, the here and now. I speak concerning Christ and the church. That's its purpose. Everything else is incidental. Verse 33, nevertheless, even though the physical is really less important than the spirit, that does not mean that you take for granted the physical as if it doesn't matter. Oh, it does matter. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband for the office sake, for the office sake. It's hard to do, isn't it? So that relationship of loving authority, that's what it's supposed to be. They are absolutely supposed to be partners. Well, how can they be partners if one has the authority and the other doesn't? How can the Father and Jesus Christ be perfect in unity when one has the authority and the other doesn't? Yeah, it is possible. That's the God realm, which means we better figure out how to do it. The relationship of a loving authority is the foundation of a proper marriage and the necessary environment for raising healthy children unto God. And then next, the parent-child relationship. So husband and wife, that's one plane. And all of a sudden, now we get a vertical one. Parent to child teaches us a different aspect about the same godly authority. Keep going in chapter 6, verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, For this is right, honor thy father and mother, which is the first command with promise. It's the fifth commandment in Exodus 20. But God says it's the first of the commandments that has a special promise that goes with it. That it may be well with thee and thou mayest live long on the earth. So to emphasize how important it is and how real the rule is that God created, to say that children need to be respectful of their parents, and that doesn't end just when they grow up and get out on their own. This means a lifelong respect for those seniors, even when physically the relationships turn and the parents become weak and need to be helped and sustained by the children. When you have a society where elders, where parents are respected, and where children grow up to take care of the elderly, you have a successful and a happy society. And when you have one without that, you have curses galore, like we have today. Verse 4, and ye fathers, is it just a one-way thing? Children, you got to respect for your parents, but parents can kind of treat the kids however they want, especially fathers who are the ones that have the greatest authority in the family, at the expense of the children. Oh, no. Ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Don't misuse your family authority and not take your children into consideration in what you do, because God is watching. Are you there as a parent to help your children grow, to learn, and to accomplish so that they can be productive adults in society when they're on their own? Are your children just like little minions that you use to manipulate to make yourself feel better? Sadly, a lot of adults have treated their kids that way. And their children pay the price, and the parents are cursed as well. So in every one of these, authority, family relationships, there is an obligation on both sides. And there is God judging and evaluating on both sides to see how well we are or are not fulfilling our particular roles. Respect for parents brings along a happy life. But that's only physical too. Remember, I'm emphasizing the temporary nature of all this stuff. When you die, what good is it? The flesh profits nothing. Here today and gone tomorrow. 1 Corinthians 15, the resurrection chapter, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 19. If in this life only, on the earth today, and your little piece of the timeline, while you're alive and breathing, if in this life only we have hope in Christ, if your idea of Christianity is about I want to be a good Christian, yes, because I want the blessings and I don't want the curses, and I believe the rules are real, and if I obey them, I'm going to be better off than if I disobey them. So while I'm alive on the earth, I want to orient my life around respecting God's Ten Commandments, including the laws for family. I want to find a life partner, I want to marry, and I want to have children, and I want to fulfill my obligation as a mate, and I want to raise my children. And at the end of my life, hopefully my children will have turned out to be well-adjusted, responsible individuals who can help take care of me when I'm weak. And then I can die, happy ending. I died having had a happy physical life. Yay. Is that what it's about? Is that all you want? You want to die having been happy for a few years? If in this life only we have hope in Christ, I'm going to say in his laws and his rules, we are of all men most miserable. Do it the best you possibly can, get a terrific result, but if you die and you don't live again, you lose. Because you were not created just to have a happy life on this earth right now. You were created to be immortal members of the God family forever. And if you don't have that happen, this whole thing was a waste. But now, is Christ risen from the dead and become the first fruits of them that slept? He's the first who made that transition from death to a resurrection to immortality, sitting at the right hand of his Father's throne, and he wants to usher a whole lot more into that same realm. For since by man came death, by man came also the resurrection of the dead through Jesus Christ. It's all about the resurrection. Another quote from Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, he said, quote, at birth of human flesh, one is delivered from his mother's womb into the world. When born of the Spirit, one will be delivered from the church of God, the physical, into the kingdom of God, a kingdom of spirit beings. You see, so God created these relationships to show the physical shows the duality of the more important spiritual. Why did he create it? So that mothers bear the children. And those children aren't conceived without the father, but the mother then is the one who carries that child to term. And when the child is born, then it can live on its own, meaning it can breathe and have its blood supply without being dependent physically upon the mother through that umbilical cord. And all of that is, why did God make it that way? Because he's teaching us something about the spirit realm. In the day when children are changed to be added to the God family, and then you have inherent life. You don't need air, you don't need food anymore. And by the way, you don't need the church anymore. Aren't you saying the church isn't eternal? I'm saying the Sabbath goes away. I'm saying male and female goes away. And I'm saying the church goes away. Because there was no church until man was created on this earth. And it was created again as a temporary institution to teach us how to think like God. But once the plan is perfected, there's no more earth, there's no more human beings, there's no more need for a church either. There was not a church before. That's my best evidence. If you think I'm going way off the rail, do you think there was a church? Did God and Jesus Christ go to a church service? I'm not aware in the Bible. All that was created for us to teach us lessons about the God realm. When that plan is completed, we're going to be totally unified with oneness, but we don't need all of these temporary symbols anymore. So I don't know that that's what Mr. Armstrong meant, but he said, when born of the Spirit, one will be delivered from the church of God. You will be, you know, we'll say, well, deliver me from evil. No, I'm saying that. But you are delivered from, you come away out of, and now you're not depending upon it to sustain your life through an umbilical cord anymore. You have independent life apart from the mother's womb and apart from the church. You have self-sustaining life as a member of the God family. Galatians 3, verse 26 first. We are begotten through baptism of God by faith in Jesus Christ. That's what it says here. Galatians 3, 26. You are all the children of God by faith in Jesus Christ. For as many of you as have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ. That's where the spiritual begettal happens. When you're begotten spiritually, which God gave us the symbolism of the conception of a new little wife and a mother, a new little life in a mother's womb, to teach us about something that's invisible. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 2. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 2. Do you not know that the saints shall judge the world? What's all this about? God is cultivating character in us so that if we are born into his family, we'll be able to use power responsibly. Because he's not going to give God power to beings who don't respect authority. That would be foolish, and God is not foolish. Do you not know that saints shall judge the world, the ones who are born into that family? They're going to be kings and they're going to be priests. They have offices to execute. They're going to be doing work. And if the world shall be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? Meaning now. What are the smallest matters? Now. Family relationships. Husbands toward wives. Wives toward husbands. Parents toward children. Children toward parents. There's the essence of small matters. By comparison to that unity and that use of authority in the God family, what you're a part of right now are small matters. They're not unimportant matters. Oh, they're critical matters, because is it the basis of our judgment? Are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? Verse 3, know you not that we shall judge angels? The angelic host, these spirit beings that already exist, are going to be under the authority of the expanded God family. You're going to have your own offices, your own jurisdictions. How much more the things that pertain to this life? What are the things that pertain to this life as God has directed it? Number one, personal and family authority. And then we can expand and talk about civic authority, talking about, you know, the authority that God gave to nations, even when they're abusive, that we have to be subject to the magistrates and the powers, even though I hate it. But that's a part of the test. As long as they don't make us violate the law of God, we are subject to their edicts, even when they're abusive and foolish and stupid, which many are, but we're subject to it. We respect it because it's a God-ordained office. So all of these authority relationships that exist on the earth are the smaller matters. But how we respond and either fulfill them or fail to fulfill them is telling God everything about our mental orientation and whether we're going to be a fit member of the God family in the future. How we handle the small matters now says everything about how we would handle the important matters in eternity. Fulfilling family obligations are commands that pertain to this life, which is being used to judge whether we are fit for the eternal family of God. So that's the framework I wanted to start with. I don't know if that sounds like good news or not, but it is. It is good news because it's true. It's part of the good news of the way God is bringing salvation to the human family. And if you understand it, and if you have the context of all of these relationships on this earth in mind, and you're working to fulfill them, you are ahead of the game. You are so much better off than the people in this world who are trying to make up their own rules and ignore the reality of what God made holy. But back to that question for the next message, what about those many, and I mean many, who have never experienced a blessed family life? Many of you are scarred. You've been beat up, abused. You haven't really experienced the glory of all these good things that were possible according to God's rules. In God's kingdom, will those who have had negative experiences physically in the flesh today, will they go through all eternity? If they make it into God's kingdom, will they go through all eternity missing something? Because the common perception, I have heard it for decades. I'm praying that God will let me find a mate. Now I can have children. Because if I never had a chance to experience a positive marriage and have my own children, even if I make it into God's kingdom, I would go through eternity having something missing inside. Is that true? I'm giving you an answer in the back of the book. No, it is not true. And so in the next message for me, I'm going to give you the good news for the lonely. Thank you.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented Good News Through Symbols, the third message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled The Good News of God's Kingdom, given for the second day of the Feast of Tabernacles in Townsend, Tennessee, October 8th, 2025. Thank you.